Now, if you would be good enough just to start off, Harriet, by giving your full name and your address, so I'll have that.
It's on. Okay. My name is Harriet Bailey Kahn. Actually, I was born Harriet Best Bailey. I'm daughter of attorney R.L. Bailey and Mrs. Bailey. I was born in 1922. I assume your interest has to do with concerns in the early 1930s, which basically were things of which I have little real knowledge. All I have there is hearsay and tradition. Basically, I think you're interested in my father. And I can tell you that he was graduated from the Indiana Law School in 1913. There's an ashtray. One of his professors at that time was James M. Ogden, who later became Attorney General. During the time my father was in law school.
Was Ogden from around here?
As far as I know, he was. Mm-hmm. I really don't know precisely. Mr. Ogden, when Ogden became Attorney General, he apparently had a small staff, judging by the opinions of the Attorney General, and he appointed my father special deputy, or special assistant, I think was the term. There may have been three deputies, no more. As far as I know, or it was popularly supposed that that was the first appointment of a Negro to the Attorney General's office. My father had taken the senior law school prize when he was in school for an article he did on insurance, and I have seen documents indicating that Mr. Ogden had always taken an interest in him and his ability. Among other things, he probably had sponsored him in becoming the first Negro member of the Indianapolis Bar Association, in fact, the only one for a good many years, until the time of his death in 1940. Prior to that time, my father was very interested in the NAACP. My earliest recollection consists of going to various places throughout the state of Indiana with my parents for evening meetings and sleeping on various people's beds during the meeting and coming home. Places like Marion, Kokomo, precisely, as far as Marion goes, I remember very well Dr. and Mrs. W.T. Bailey, who were the plaintiffs in the only recorded civil rights action under the old law, Bailey v. Washington Theater. My father was involved in it at the trial level and died before appeal, at which time the appeal was perfected by Mr. Brokenbur, who was my father's associate. My father's law office was at 41 North Pennsylvania Street, the old Benton Pierce building, throughout my lifetime. Apparently that's where he started when he started practice. He was initially associated with Mr. Brokenbur, who I've previously mentioned, later State Senator Robert Lee Brokenbur, and with Mr. Ransom, who left the practice of law and became manager of the Madam C.J. Walker Manufacturing Company. After Mr. Ransom left, the third person who shared the offices, it was an association rather than a partnership, was Forrest W. Littlejohn, who at one point became also a state representative. My father apparently was almost permanent candidate for various political offices, most of which he did not, in fact, none of them was he elected to, and most of them he didn't get out of the primary, though in some cases he may have been the leading black candidate, always for the Republican Party. With that kind of background, you can see that how he happened to be in the Attorney General's office. One of his claims to fame was that he never lost an appeal. when he was with the Attorney General. That's not hard to do, actually, because all the presumptions are on the side of the state. But when I was there, I did occasionally lose a few cases. Let's see. He always handled civil rights cases for the, whether they were NAACP motivated or not. One of the last cases that he handled, at that point I was in school, was a Swain case, which is recorded, in which he both took an appeal and also a coram nobis, and they were decided side by side. Swain had apparently killed a grocer in the robbery and was he was illiterate. And there was a question as to his being advised of rights and so forth. In any event, the case was lost. The coram nobis issue was whether or not there had been systematic exclusion of Negroes from the jury. It was lost because the record was not adequate to definitely establish that one way or the other, at least in the view of the court. He was attorney for a case called Great House against the Board of School Commissioners, at which time he was trying to prevent the erection of Alex High School. He lost that. My reading of the opinion indicates that he advanced some of the same ideas that were successful in Brown v. Board of School Commission, Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas. My particular recollection is that he indicated that no one high school could provide the benefits that were available to whites in that Shortridge was an academic high school. Manual was specializing in manual training, and Technical was presenting specialized courses in technical training. Court didn't buy that either. I think he was in the minority then. I'm not sure who Mr. Greathouse was, but somebody at one time said that he was an Indiana Avenue denizen. I would say probably my father needed a plaintiff in the suit. He represented various people. There's a case I came across when I first came here called Harrison May, in which he got a guilty plea set aside, which was precedental for the kind of work I'm doing here. One of my recollections, and I can't tell you now who the man was, there are newspaper clippings at home I could find out, but I didn't know you were coming today. But in any case, he saved a man from execution because of the, I think probably the order had not been signed. My recollection of the story is something along these lines, that my father went to the courthouse and looked up the records and found that it had not been properly signed, and went and got a photographer and came back and took a picture of the record. Afterwards, people they wanted to know what he looked at, and they discovered the omission, and I think the court signed it, but it was after term time or whatever. And on that technicality, his life was saved. The important fact from my standpoint was that the people in South Bend had a testimonial dinner for him as a consequence of that, and I was not allowed to go to the dinner, but I did go to South Bend. And I can't tell you the nature of the cases he handled in Illinois, but he was admitted to practice in Illinois, and he made a number of trips to Chicago, where he was generally associated with an attorney by the name of Dick Westbrooks, who was a great criminal trial lawyer in Chicago. I can remember also that my mother was not very much in sympathy with the kinds of cases he took, because they were frequently non-paying cases. On one occasion, he went to Evansville, where the NAACP was having supposedly a mammoth gathering to raise funds for the defense of somebody he was representing, and they barely collected enough to pay his way back to Indianapolis. As I mentioned, the last case of which I had any recollection was Swain. He wanted to take it to the United States Supreme Court. My understanding was they refused to accept it as a pauper case, and that he didn't feel that he had the money to pay the cost. I question that from my present standpoint as an attorney, because unless the rules have changed, the United States Supreme Court would not have been obliged to accept cert anyhow. But my mother's story is that he felt so badly on the occasion when Swain actually did meet his death that he went to Richmond, where his best friend was C.R. Richardson, another attorney, and they probably got drunk together on the occasion. He felt badly. Certainly when I was in college, I did get the Recorder newspaper every week. They sent it to me, and I saw the picture of Swain with his head shaven conferring with my father and an attorney in Michigan City who was local counsel by the name of Tenola Graves. I suspect Swain had as many as 3 Last Suppers before he was finally executed. It would be difficult to say what cases he handled or didn't handle. In some respects, I think he was legendary. There is a man, and he's still living, by the name of Lucian Meriwether, who was the first black... Oh, I can mention that, too. He was the first black elected to the city council of Indianapolis, a dentist. He was my father's client in a... spike fence case when Dr. Meriwether bought a house on Capitol Avenue about 2300 block. He was the first black, and the neighbors were so incensed that they erected a fence so tall that they couldn't see out on any side. And that case was won at the trial court level. I think we got down to the point where you can't have fences more than 6 feet tall. It was, according to my recollection, it also involved a municipal ordinance which was probably declared unconstitutional. There was a similar one that I have come across in Louisville, which I think was probably declared unconstitutional by the United States Supreme Court, which would be segregated housing. The net result was that we didn't pass laws restricting residences, but it was an unwritten law, and it was honored by realtors. As a matter of fact, when I was trying to buy a house in 1949 as a young woman with children, a realtor had shown me a house on Harvard, which was about 3900 north and about 400 west, which was really not large enough for my family, and I saw in the paper the next day that he was advertising another house, which was about 5 blocks away, but on the other side of Meridian, or maybe, I don't remember where it was closer to Meridian Street, and he informed me that he couldn't show me that one, because of course he knew I was colored. I think maybe I've said most of the things. Oh, I was going to say that Dr. Meriwether indicates that at some occasion, my father was involved in an anti-miscegenation case in which he lectured to the court on Moses. Presumably Moses was married to a girl of different race. I'm not sure whether she was supposed to be black, but certainly my recollection is that she was not Jewish or Egyptian at the time. That was one of Jethro's daughters, if I remember accurately. He also was reported to have told a court in Dr. Merriweather's presence that there was a higher court than he. So if he ruled against him, he intended to take an appeal. I can't supply any real first-hand information about his cases. There were several people who apparently were entertained and interested enough that they went around with him when he had trials of cases that were interesting, but I would say probably no one still lives except Dr. Merriweather. There was another man by the name of Louis Butler who was dead and told a few tales. At the time my father died, there was a man who had been a hanger-on for a while. Don't remember what his name was, but I think he probably had a scar, and my recollection is a squint in the eye, a bad-looking character who had been going around as my father's bodyguard. He was a former prisoner. And the most striking thing I remember there is he slammed the door so hard during the wake that he broke the front door glass. But that really is about all I can tell you. Oh, as far as the Marion case, I knew about it, and I knew that the Attorney General had apparently made history in involving himself in the lynching. I would suspect that my father had some influence in it. But I don't really myself remember being told much about that one. However, Merle Wall was a Deputy Attorney General when I was in the Attorney General's office, and he had been one of Mr. Ogden's deputies. And he indicated that Ogden had sent the two of them to Marion to investigate. My recollection also is that probably as a private attorney, my father represented one of the boy who was not lynched. And I'm hazy whether he got off or not. I think he did, but he didn't. But he did represent him. Robert Lieutenant Bailey.
Robert Lieutenant. Do you have any recollection of whether there might have been another R.L. Bailey other than Marion that was somewhat involved with it? And there was, if you ever had a bill.
My father didn't live in Marion, but he was there frequently. As I said, it was W.T. Bailey, and my father was frequently there.
I suspect this has been confused some way. I have two R.L. Baileys. And your father, I know, and then there's another one that shows up on telegram from Marion, Indiana, and I suspect it was your father.
I suspect so.
Distorted some way. I find it unlikely that it was identical attachments in the same name. And this is
Miss Flossie Catherine.
Flossie Catherine. Mm-hmm. She was the president of the NAACP state at the time.
Oh, that's possible. She was. She was very active. She was more active than W.T.
Right. And he was a physician?
He was a physician.
General practice.
Right.
Did you ever hear of a fellow by the name of Arthur Bonner, V-A-U-N-E-R?
No.
The evidence is that he was an investigator out of the Attorney General.
Yes, he was an attorney. I don't remember much about him, but it's just one of the names that I do recall.
You don't have any idea of whether or not
I don't know.
Robert L. Brokenberg.
That's Robert Lee Brokenberg.
Robert Lee?
Right.
There's the name C.S. Brown.
No. The way I knew Faith Brown, it probably was her father. She was active with the NAACP.
Was she from Marion?
I think. I may... I'd have to ask my mother whether it was Marion or Kokomo.
Who was your father born?
In Alabama.
In Alabama.
The vicinity of... Frankly, I suspect the nearest place would be Killen, which he never heard of. But that wasn't what he claimed. Florence was the largest town. He was a contemporary of W.C. Handy of the St. Louis Blues fame. And Handy had... places around there were Handy Hill and Bailey Chapel. But his brother owned about five... Well, I guess his father was a farmer. And his brother owned about 500 acres when I was a child. And
your father's brother?
Yes. And his post office address was Killen. But his sister lived in Florence. And my father went and stayed with her to go to school so that until he was prepared for college. He went to college at Talladega.
When did it happen?
He graduated. Well, he graduated from Talladega in 1906 as the youngest member of his class. The employment that was open to educated men there was rather limited, and he became a railway mail clerk. I'm sure that at some point Rome, Georgia was either the beginning or the end of a run, or he went through it. He married a woman from Atlanta, Georgia, who went to the Atlanta University. And during the time he was a railway mail clerk, he not only foiled a bandit from the mail cars, he also testified, and it was said that he had created enemies to the extent that he probably felt like he needed to go elsewhere. I don't know whether that's true or not, but it was said by a man named Glenn, who spoke at an anniversary of the founding of the National Alliance of Postal Employees, which my father had been founder and first national secretary for. And he indicated that my father had never, this is fiction, I know, he said he'd never resigned from the railway mail service, that he'd just taken a leave of absence. The reason I know it's not so is because somewhere I have seen the actual resignation letter. But he had taken a correspondence course in law while he was in Georgia, and I don't think that satisfied him. As I've mentioned before, Mr. Richardson, they became friends in college. Richardson, Cornelius Roscoe. Richardson went to Tuskegee, my father went to Talladega, and they had debated one another, opposing teams. Richardson was from Athens, Georgia. His grandmother had raised him. He was the youngest child, and an older brother and sister became employees of the federal government in Washington, and the older sister, well, in fact, the whole family moved there, and he went to Howard to law school. And my father was also interested, and he couldn't get law, of course, in Georgia, so he came north to Indiana. Now, why he selected Indiana, nobody ever told me. He did go to the Indiana, as I said, old Indiana Law School.
Who was that?
It was a night school here, and it was an antecedent of the present IU School of Law. There was old Indiana Law School, I can't tell you, I never saw it. And there was the Ben Harrison Law School, And Ben Harrison merged in with Indiana Law School, and Indiana Law School was merged ultimately with the IU School of Law, Indianapolis Division, which it was when I went to school. It was not Indiana University. Oh, anyway, that's roughly what happened, and the story was, as far as Mr. Richardson was, that he went as far west as his money would take him, and that's why he settled in Richmond, Indiana. In any case, they all three appeared to be here at approximately the same time. Mr. Brokenburg started practice in 1912, and as I said, my father in 1913. And I'm not really exactly sure at what point, what year Mr. Richardson, but all of them about the same time. And there was quite a network of, I guess you'd have to say, educated Negroes at that time who didn't have access to hotels. So whenever they came, had business in a town or a reason to go, they always stayed with somebody. One of the jokes in our house was that my mother gave my father a set of dishes for his birthday because of the fact that Walter White of the NAACP was coming to town and she needed them for dinner. But I know a lot of names. Oh, yeah.
His
wife, Alice. Met him, and of course Mordecai Johnson. But this, I mean, these names were people that went through, but why they came here, I can't tell you. But
you recollect the Walter White being here in connection
with his marriage? No, I don't recall that. I think he came to talk.
He was here
on several occasions, but I don't recall his being connected with that.
One of the great experiences I've had recently was when I was in Washington.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, Walter White was from Atlanta, too.
Yeah.
So that was part of it, the friendship, yeah. I mean, and the connection that began.
I kind of got interested in him. He was a fascinating character. And so Clarence and I, well, we had a delightful afternoon, about 3 hours just talking about some things that he and I had done in common when I was in Washington and about the interrelations he had. And so, consequently, I got White's book, Flint and Fire.
No.
It's kind of interesting. It was written in 1924, and it's a pretty damn good book. And I'm surprised somebody hasn't picked it up and done some serialization or something with it, because it's around a southern setting with an educated...
it's fiction. Fiction?
Yeah. Well, I presume so. Well, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's touted as fiction. I'm sure that he may have had some in mind. It's a young black... who went east and became a doctor and came back to this community and had these very idealistic attitude about things, knew what was involved, what had to be done, but it was kind of like, they don't bother you and you don't bother them, everything's going to go on, and found out soon that was not the way it worked. And so there's a series of tragedies. And so it really grabbed at the end because it's a typical type Lynch thing that's set up with all the excuses and things. Gives you an insight to this person, this human being, who's very bright, very educated, very compassionate. And in the end, he has printed a typical Lynch release. That's the way the story ends today. Dr. So-and-so, a black physician, a Negro physician in so-and-so town, Georgia, went crazed for some reason, drank or something else after attempting to attack a white woman and was shot by. It's really a thought that I don't know.
What's the name of it?
It's called Flint and the Fire. And he was really a courageous guy. Of course, he looked Caucasian. And he used that to the nth degree because he had some reports out, original files from where he was here. And he really got